listening to Real Talk on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
You're on Reality Check Radio, Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. I say that we're blessed with our guests, but truly, we haven't been more blessed than with our next guest, because her story is amazing. I'm speaking this morning with Victoria Bruce. Good morning.
Kia ora, good morning, Rodney. Thank you for having me.
Look, I literally, it's been like Christmas interviewing you. I haven't been able to sleep.
Oh, thank you so much.
I love your story. I love what you have done. And I'm going to love reading your book. I want listeners to know how significant this is by when I find it. Oh, what have I done? Just give me a minute, please, everyone. Here it is. This is Tim Mathis, an American who's what's called a through hiker, and they walk from one spot to another spot, as I can understand it. And he read Victoria's book called Adventures with Emily. Emily is spelled E-M-I-L-I-E. Now, picture this. He says, I don't normally review books, but I'm reviewing this book because I'm scared that you might miss it. This is to an American audience. And he says this. Is there more appeal within the through hiking community than wild or a walk in the woods? Now, Walk in the Woods is Bill Bryson's book, like the number one bestseller author. It will have more appeal than a walk in the woods. But it describes the internal journey more effectively than Through Hiking Will Break Your Heart, another book. He loves this book. He says in conclusion, it is a great book. I think you'll like it. I didn't want you to miss it. That's quite something, Victoria.
Yeah, absolutely. It was absolutely beautiful to connect with someone like Tim, a member of the through hiking community and an author, a fabulous author himself in his own right, who is also a psychiatric nurse with a very interesting background of his own. So I was really, really surprised, humbled and delighted to have the support of Tim.
Well, I had never heard of your book, and I love reading and I love journeys. Everyone loves a journey. Like, what is the book is about? It's about a journey. And your book is a physical journey and a mind journey and a child journey all in one, which is everything. It's like the Odyssey, right? How can it not be irresistible? And then the picture on the front cover is just astonishing. I've got to tell you, when you've got to look at this book, Victoria Bruce, Adventures with Emily, and there's a picture of you with your seven-year-old daughter. She has a full pack on, as do you, and you're standing up high on the tops overlooking, well, it looks like a Canterbury River. Whereabouts are you with that picture?
I think we're just coming down from Stag Saddle, which is coming into Camp Stream around the sort of Tekapol area.
Mm.
So we're probably looking just over a ridge, maybe somewhere at Mount Cook.
The story.
This photo would be about 100 days into the trail.
Victoria, just to cut to the chase, walked, I'm going to get it wrong, Te Araroa. How is that?
It's perfect.
Te Araroa. I almost get scared when I'm about to say it. Te Araroa. This is the hiking track that's a tramp from one end of New Zealand to the other. And Victoria, over 138 days, hiked this tramp with her seven-year-old. That's astonishing. It's astonishing. That's like sailing around the world.
It was a big journey for sure. So it took us, 6 months to walk from the top of the North Island to the bottom of the South Island. And it really was, a life-changing experience for both of us for the better.
A bit. Now, tell us about yourself previous to doing this tramp.
Yeah, absolutely. So prior to taking on this big trip, I was a 36-year-old single mother. I was living in Christchurch and I was working as a communications advisor with the City Council's information unit. And I had been taking Emily in on overnight and multi-day tramping trips since she was 4 years old. So we'd sort of stumbled upon the New Zealand Backcountry Hut Network, and we had been taking ourselves out there on our weekends and our school holidays with our packs and our bulky old gear, and having overnights in little huts or in our tent. And it was as though we were kind of exploring this almost like a parallel world where we would go out into the wilderness and just have so much fun and freedom together, and then come back to what was really for me a very busy and hectic life, working full time as a single parent with a little, preschool and then early school age child who was often the first one at before school care and the last one at after school care.
Tell me,
So,
had you been a tramper yourself before Emily?
I had not really, no. I mean, I'm first generation Kiwi. My parents are from Scotland, and however, I did grow up in Australia. I grew up very rural. We were homeschooled, and I had my older brother for company, and we just had the bush as our playground. So we were accustomed to spending, lots of time hours. We would do our lessons in the morning, and then we would just, escape off into the back paddocks and go play in the bush together, my brother and I. So I was accustomed to living outdoors and playing outdoors. But as I became a young adult, I came really disconnected from nature, and I didn't. So I wasn't particularly outdoorsy. I thought the outdoor community was for really fit, tough people, not
Well,
me.
that's what I keep
And
thinking.
but it's not really, really, it's for everybody. And it was only on returning to New Zealand 10 years ago that I just started spending more time going for little day walks with the baby in my pack, and eventually leading up to overnight trips.
What are these back country huts like?
Oh, they are gorgeous. They range. So, in the Department of Conservation's Backcountry Hut Network, I think there's over 900 huts and shelters, and they range from anything from a little, 1 to 2 bunk bivouac, which is like a tiny little shelter, to, the old Forestry Service huts, which is sort of 4 to 6 bunks, to more custom built, newer models, and of course the monstrosities of our great hut. Our great walk huts. So they're sort of basic, they're basic shelters, usually with bunks, maybe a sink or a cooking bench, maybe with water from the stream nearby or water from a tank, maybe with a long drop toilet or maybe not.
That's very basic.
Yeah, but it's very magical too to come across and to think that out there in the hills there are all these little huts that you can just bring your stuff to and make it your home for the night.
Do you? I would worry about rats and bugs. Is that a worry to you?
It's not a worry per se. I have gotten up a bit more close and personal with mice more than rats, more than I've really liked. There are often, you know, introduced pests out there in our forest wreaking havoc, you know, possums and rats and mice and so on. But a lot of the shelters are cared for either by volunteer groups or members of the community or the Department of Conservation themselves. And so, you know, these sorts of things are under control in places, and we're not, I think you just sort of learn to deal with them. There's definitely been moments, I write about it in my book, where we, you know, set up our gear in a little hut in the afternoon and then skipped off to play and came back at dusk and opened the door and found a huge rat cruising around in the rafters.
Oh,
and
God.
Yeah, absolutely.
I just
wanted to run for it. Oh, I wanted to run for it, set up my tent. But Emily was like, oh, that's cute, mummy.
Funny enough, I always have to put my big boy pants on because my wife is more scared of mice and rats than I am. So I have to pretend that I'm brave and courageous and a knight in shining armor and deal to it. But, and what about safety? Like, you're a young woman with a young girl and you're staying in a hut with strangers. Is that a worry to you?
No, look, it hasn't really been a worry to me. I mean, a lot of the time that we are in the huts alone by ourselves, and I find, you know, mainly people in the outdoor tramping and hunting communities are, you know, yes, they share a common affinity to the outdoors. I think if you're far away in the bush and away from the road end, you'll hopefully be away from the crazy people.
Yeah.
I would feel more unsafe, you know, maybe walking around the city streets at night, yes, than I would being deep in the backcountry.
So here you are, you're a solo mother living in Christchurch, working. You're a professional communicator, which is to say a writer, I guess.
That's correct.
How did you become a writer?
I studied journalism at the University of Queensland in Australia. It wasn't my first choice. I grew up after, you know, spending all that time in the bush as a child, I grew up wanting to be a zoologist or a marine biologist. But I had a difficult childhood that kind of threw me off track very early, and it took a while to claw my way back.
And that still haunts you a bit.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, yeah.
Do you want to share that with us?
Yeah, yes, I can. I absolutely can. So I suppose I kind of went through this childhood, which to me was normal. I never thought to question it. I'm not sure how many of us ever actually do sit up and think to question our childhoods and what our parents did and said. Often you just take the word and actions of your parents as fact, as God in a way, and go through life carrying perhaps these traumas and these wounds that we don't really realize that we carry. So for me, I grew up sort of quite isolated and homeschooled, and I think later in life, I realized that, you know, my parents had a very complex relationship, and there was a lot of violence and there was a lot of fear, especially, you know, we were scared of my father, and my mother was a very sweet lady, but unable to, I guess, stand up to him. She was very scared of him. And as a child, I remember, I suppose, being very scared of him. I don't remember being scared, but I remember never wanting to be near him. I don't remember ever cuddling him. I don't remember ever sitting on his knee. I don't remember ever wanting to. I remember as a young teenager, the physical discomfort of having to sit in the front seat of the car next to him and the proximity to his arm if he wanted to lash out at me. And anyway, I sort of grew up with this, you know, abusive family situation that I perhaps you know, wasn't very aware of. I was very sheltered from it being the youngest. And then when I was 9, my parents separated. It was all a bit of a blur, but I sort of had this vague memory of my mother saying that my father was away. And she said to my brother and I one afternoon, when your father gets home with the car, we three are going to get in it and we're going to leave. And I don't know what I was up to. I was just a 9-year-old kid. And I think I said, I'm not doing that. I'd always been taught about fairness, and I was pretty sure that 3-1 didn't sound very fair. And who knows, maybe I hadn't got what I wanted that day and I wasn't feeling very cooperative. But when my dad got home with the car, my mum and my brother got in it. I refused to get in it. And they left, and I watched them drive down this long driveway and up over the bend, and then they were gone. And I don't really remember anything in the ensuing weeks and months and, I don't know, years, really. My memory was very little snippets of things here and there. But, but my father descended into, you know, alcoholism, pretty overt alcoholism and despair after that. And it was very hard to be around him. I was suddenly very exposed to his anger and his dark moods. And I guess I had nobody else there to turn to. So I guess for survival, my little child brain and nervous system just started adapting to something. And anyway, several years later, I ended up in foster care. I was back in New Zealand. I'd been staying with my grandparents, and something had happened, and one thing led to another, and suddenly I was signed over to the state as a ward of the state. And that was a terrifying and very confusing, prolonged experience where, you know, I was abused, I suffered sexual abuse, I was shuttled around to different carers. I ran away from pretty much every placement they put me in. There was a lot of access to drugs, to very dangerous people, and the types of people that actually I'd never been exposed to before. You know, my parents, despite the domestic violence, you know, they were, I don't know, vegetarian. And, you know, we were taught things, and we didn't get exposed to, you know, criminals and drug addicts actually as a child. And in foster care, they were right there, you know, right in the houses where I was staying, eyeing me up because I was a, you know, developing 14, 15-year-old. And eventually at age 16, I was declared a legal adult, and I got given my passport back, and I was there to begin my life as an adult person. And I went back to Australia, which is, you know, kind of the country I knew, I guess. And I went off the rails completely. I guess I got myself into a heroin addiction, which I hadn't sort of meant to do, but it was just there. And I think I was just so wild with pain and rage that probably looking back, self-medicating or something like that was maybe helpful, because you know, the opiates certainly soothed a lot of absolutely overwhelming grief and pain and rage that I certainly, you know, wouldn't have known how to cope with. And anyway, eventually I got myself off that, and after time I went back into study. I had always very much wanted to go to university for some reason, and I went and did night classes because I dropped out of school in year 9, I had no chance of a university entrance, so I went and did these night classes where you get your high school certificate. And I did really well. I mean, I've always enjoyed learning in academia. But I just didn't really have any buffer. You know, I had no parental supervision or support, no other adults around. I was probably, you know, trudging from one share house to the next, you know, sleeping on a mattress on top of stolen milk crates. couldn't afford the textbooks, couldn't manage when things got tough. So, you know, I kind of lurched about for a while and eventually studied nursing and worked as a nurse, which wasn't quite what I could manage as such a young person, perhaps. I found it, some of it, very heavy and very distressing. And I eventually signed up for this journalism thing because I thought, well, you know what? I've always enjoyed writing, so maybe I could just be good at that. And I got into journalism at the University of Queensland, and really it was there, actually. I met some adults that I connected with. I connected deeply with a couple of my lecturers, and I think there was a assignment about our media consumption, you know, tell us how you consume media and what it's like for you. And I wrote the scathing report saying, you know, I do not believe in the watching of television. It is the opiate of the masses. And my lecturer was like, okay, how about you come and have a chat with me? Because you seem like an interesting person. And I disclosed a bit of my past and my life, and which is something I never really talked about. It was always buried as a secret shame, you know. And he encouraged me to perhaps reframe my view of myself as seeing myself as someone who had battled very hard to be where I am, and to see my strengths and to see everything that I'd been through as challenges that I had overcome, which was very helpful, actually, to have to have somebody suggest that to me. And I guess that sort of helped change a little bit of how I viewed myself and the world. But what I didn't understand about myself was often how I felt. You know, I got very good marks with my coursework, and I did a lot of work experience, and I, you know, got into, you know, working as a journalist, and really everything should have been fine, except I would go through these periods of where everything in my body just told me that everything was not fine, and that I was dying, and I was terrible and worthless, and I didn't deserve to be there. And this was very hard, and I didn't really understand what was wrong with me. I just knew a deep down in my body that I was this broken, worthless, unlovable person. And sadly, without any challenging viewpoints, that was something that I simply took for granted and believed to be true, all until many years later when I finally had my beautiful little daughter and suffered from, I guess, a form of, you know, postnatal depression or something that I didn't see the other mothers going through. And I reached out and sat there on Google last night. I was like, right, I need to talk to somebody. I must go and see a counsellor. So I typed in counsellor and I found one locally, and I made an appointment and went to see her. And as part of the, you know, the history, she asked me about my family, and she asked me, had I ever been sexually abused? And I thought, who is this bloody nosy woman? But I thought, well, I'll be full disclosure here. So I said to her, yes, I was raped when I was 14. And she said, right, well, I'll get the ACC form out, and we'll put in a claim, and this will all be covered for you. And I thought, oh, what does that mean? But I learnt what it meant, and it really was the start of a I guess, a therapeutic journey where I have been able to access some counselling and therapeutic support, which culminated in being assessed and diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder and major depressive disorder about 6 years ago. So in a very long answer to your question, prior to walking to Aotearoa with Emily, I was also a single mother with a new mortgage, working as a nurse, a very stressful job during the pandemic, and coming to terms with, I have this thing called post-traumatic stress disorder. And once a week I go to a therapist and try to understand what the hell that means.
Were you on psychiatric drugs?
I have been, but there really is no medication for post-traumatic stress disorder. Mm. Some of the symptoms of it are anxiety and depression. And for depression, you know, they like the doctors, there's a bit of a disconnect between, say, the therapeutic community and the medical community. The doctors like to, you know, to push different types of antidepressants on you, whereas my therapist wasn't a massive fan of this. So there really isn't very much that you can do to medicate PTSD apart from, you know, trying to suppress some of the symptoms. But I guess a big part of the treatment of PTSD is the understanding that basically this is the body responding to traumatic events that happened when you were incapable of processing them. And the treatment is to be able to allow your body to process the traumatic events and hopefully to release that and return to baseline. So in a way, you need to be able to feel. So simply repressing it by taking medication is just prolonging the problem.
Mm-hmm. You have an amazing ability to analyze and describe your situation. Amazing.
Thank you.
As therapy must have helped enormously to that point, because when you went along to therapy, you weren't aware of all of this. You couldn't put it into words in a framework, I suspect.
Look, the therapeutic journey has been, it hasn't been straightforward, Rodney. I mean, while I'm very grateful that in New Zealand that we have, I guess, institutions such as ACC who recognise, I call it a mental, it's a physical accident that caused a mental injury, and therefore you get some cover and you get assistance and you get funded therapy. However, you know, again, in New Zealand, the awareness of PTSD and trauma-informed therapy is very low, and it's really a huge mix as to who you get. You know, with ACC, if you want to get a funded therapist, you go through their list of who's available. Not all of these people are clinical psychologists. They may just have a counselling diploma. They are not necessarily trauma-informed at all, and so it's a very mixed bag of who you get. So when I sort of look back on some of the early people who I saw, I guess they didn't perhaps know what questions to ask. I didn't perhaps understand what to tell them. And I think, you know, looking back, there was probably some very ineffective time spent talking to different counsellors, talking around topics, talking off topic, and also perhaps different treatment methods that were really ineffectual and quite damaging. For example, there was one therapist I had who felt that the best way to address the issue was to have me desensitization therapy, where you have the client go back to the actual event that happened and talk through it. You know, for example, you know, when I was 14, there was a particular event. I was running away from a foster home and I was hitchhiking and I got picked up by some guy who was an absolute creep who ended up, you know, driving deep into a forestry plantation and raping me in the front seat of the car and then leaving me there and driving away. And my therapist wanted me to go back to being in the forestry plantation, the smell of the pine needles, the prickle of them under my back, and which it was actually very controversial because all that really does is flood the poor person with intense distress chemicals, you know, your stress chemicals, your adrenaline and cortisol. And that is not necessarily particularly helpful at all, because what you really want a person with a dysregulated nervous system to do is to learn how to be calm, how to return, I suppose, to baseline. And anyway, but you know, you don't know what you don't know. So I just sort of, you know, allowed these people to pick at my head with inexpert tools for a while until I think what was really helpful for me in my therapeutic journey was to take this time out, the 6 months out with myself, and just reset myself, you know, remove all the stressors of my life and just focus on, you know, walking 6 to 8 hours a day through the beautiful wilderness with my little daughter, and to see how I felt as a person with all of these other stressors removed. And from then, you know, you can actually see and feel how you respond when a memory is triggered and how your emotional response is activated and how it subsides and how you feel and how you manage it. That was very helpful, having some time and space to do the healing rather than just try to fit it in an hour a week.
We're talking
as part
with,
of a very busy lifestyle.
You're on Reality Check Radio, Real Talk with Rodney Hyde, and this is a real talk. And we're talking with Victoria Bruce, her book is published by Penguin, and it's called Adventures with Emily, her beautiful daughter. Writing the book must have been cathartic too.
Oh, absolutely, Rodney. It was a real, really deep and gut-wrenching and heart-wrenching exercise writing this book. I mean, walking the length of New Zealand with my beautiful, bubbly little 7-year-old daughter for company was delightful, indescribable joy, you know, such hard work. But a beautiful, wonderful experience. And yet writing this book, almost for some time, it almost felt like punishment for something. Being, you know, locked in my home office, you know, not, of course, revisiting the beautiful memories of the places that we walked through and how we felt and what we saw, but as well, you know, doing the deep dives inside of myself to bring in this kind of parallel journey, you know, the therapeutic journey, and digging deeper into, you know, the memories of the various events of childhood trauma, which, you know, ultimately culminated in this adult diagnosis of complex PTSD. So for me, as a writer, the way I work best, I think, is it's very experiential. You know, I need to be able to kind of visualize it, drop into the situation. You know, I can. And so what I did throughout this book, you know, so these weaving these two parallel stories together, one of walking the trail with Emily and the second one of, you know, the memories and the feelings and thoughts and what was going through my body and my head at the time, I would put myself back into the situation and drop in. So, you know, when I talk about being that 9-year-old girl whose mother drove away, you know, I found it amazing how once I sat down and put myself in that place, how the words just flowed. And suddenly, you know, I'd written 3,000 words in, you know, the space of a couple of hours, how much wanted to come out. But again, it was a very difficult emotional space to put myself in, and a very lonely place to put myself in. But obviously there was a lot there to come out.
Tim Mathis describes your book. He says she brings the reader along on that journey through a series of flashbacks. It's heavy at times, but beautifully written and genuinely informative. An introduction to the embodied experience of post-traumatic stress. So you take us on this wonderful walk and the beauty of the walk, but through the walk you flash back to your traumatic childhood. So it's like two journeys intertwined.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Now tell me about, sorry, I interrupted rudely.
No, that's okay, please.
Tell me about, I get it that you're enjoying walking with your little baby and toddler, doing day walks and being brave and staying overnight. Tell us about the decision to do a tramp that is 138 days and through tough country. It's something like 400 kilometres to walk. It's not for the faint-hearted. And here you were struggling with your work and your feelings, and you decide, oh, well, I'm going to take off and not walk the length of New Zealand. That would be impressive. But tramp through the Alps, the high country of New Zealand, with my 7-year-old. What was the thinking that led you to think you should do that, and the thinking that said you could do that?
Yeah, really good questions. I guess, you know, at the time leading up to the decision to go on this walk, you know, as I said, Emily and I had been, you know, going on little trips on our weekends and our school holidays. And I just noticed so much the difference in myself and how I coped and how I felt and our interactions together. It was just so special having this magical one-on-one time with this beautiful little daughter of mine who, you know, sadly due to, you know, my work commitments, you know, apparently to feed her and clothe her and keep a roof over our heads, I just wasn't seeing very much of her. And when I got home at the end of the day, I was just this strung out, miserable, exhausted, empty ghost of a person. And yet somehow, you know, I'd be packing the packs on a Friday night and taking us out on a Saturday and sleeping in a little hut Saturday night and back on a Sunday. I just knew that actually being out there with Emily was the real world. And this place that I kept coming back to during the week, yeah, it just wasn't where I wanted to be. So at the time as well, you know, I was just having suffering from extreme burnout. And actually it was my GP who said, you know, you need to take time off. You need, you know, 6 months off. I'm signing you a letter right now for 6 months off and you shouldn't go back to work tomorrow. And I said, oh, well, I probably do have to go back to work tomorrow because I'd need to do a handover and at least, you know, try to do the professional, some form of semi-graceful professional exit. But 6 months off sounds, that sounds good. And then I thought, well, what will I do? You know, what trip could be long enough? Could we just go stay at a hut for 6 months? Oh, no, they'll probably kick us out. And then we had been on this trip where we had been staying at one of the huts that intersects the Te Araroa trail. So Te Araroa is a 3,000-kilometer trail that goes from the top of the North Island to the bottom of the South Island. And we had met this lovely man. We were staying in this little three-bunk historic hut, me and Emily, and it had gotten to evening and we'd done our dinner and we'd done all our playing, and someone banged on the door and we opened it, creaked it open, and outside was this giant man. You had to stoop to get in. And he said in the thick French accent through his big, thick beard, "Are there any bunks spare for the night?" And we said, "Well, yeah, there's one." But all these bunks were like little sacking wire, you know, because it was very old and historic. And he was so grateful to be there. And we talked to him and realized he'd walked 40 kilometers that day. We'd walked 10 and thought that was a lot for us. And that he'd come from a completely different part of the trail. He'd come over these big mountains, over the Waiau Pass, through Nelson Lakes, and that actually he'd been walking for months from the very top of the North Island. And I just thought, wow, you know, my map is only this big and I've only been looking at this little part of this track, but wow, to think that, you know, this whole country is actually a network of different tracks and trails that all connect up with each other, and you can do that. You can walk the length of New Zealand. So I had heard of a family who had done this trip, I think the year before or so, with their kids. And I thought to myself, well, Emily and I, you know, we've managed to do like a 5-day trip and we know how to follow an orange marker, a track marker, and I kind of know how to use a map and I know what to pack in my backpack. So maybe we could just try this. And if it doesn't work, well, we'll do something else. But maybe we could at least just try it and see how we go. And so I said to Emily, what do you think, you know? Should we go on a really big adventure together, just us two girls, a really long walk? And she said, yeah, that sounds great. of which I was so grateful for. And so
she was seven.
She was, a remarkable little girl. I talked to her school principal. The kids had been in and out of school with lockdowns for the last, I don't remember how long. And the principal said, well, I think it would be a wonderful life experience for Emily. And so I felt that, you know, some doors were kind of opening for us. And I knew that my time at my workplace was rapidly expiring. So I thought, oh, I'll rent out the house. 6 months is a good minimum. I'll pack up our bags and we'll just go. And I mean, it's funny, sometimes you think that something is so outside of your reach, but then little signs will occur, little offers of support, which make you think that, well, actually, maybe it's not impossible. Because I've approached some outdoor stores and said, oh, I'm thinking of doing this big walk with my child. And I thought they'd laugh and boo me out of there, but they were like, oh, cool, that sounds really sweet. Yeah, great, good on you girls. Hey, look, we can help you out with some cost-priced gear and we can do this and do that. And I was really, you know, really grateful for the support. And so, yeah, I just kept trying. I wanted to do a fundraiser as well as part of this walk, because I guess for me it was, you know, it was time out to use the long walk as a piece of therapy. You know, it was a therapeutic journey. It was time out to do some healing and to reconnect with myself and my daughter. And I knew that even though I didn't quite know what lay ahead, that I had some work to do. So we went ahead and connected with the Mental Health Foundation of New Zealand and Federated Mountain Clubs, who are an outdoor advocacy group. And we felt, you know, we really liked the ethos that these two organizations offered. And so we offered to fundraise for them to the sum of $20,000, you know, $10,000 each And, you know, my journalist and communications brain immediately put together a bit of a, you know, a plan, set up some social media channels. And before we knew it, we had one of the television stations wanting to interview us. I think it was Seven Sharp, interview us and do a segment on us, the mother and daughter walking the length of New Zealand for mental health. And it all just sort of started to snowball in a wonderful way. Yeah, I thought, well, look, let's just try and see if we can do it. And I think it was after the first week that we walked the length of 90 Mile Beach, which is, you know, over 100 kilometres. It's a really long way, and beaches aren't idyllic and sunny and full of palm trees up there. They're pretty wild, and, you know, when the weather rolls in, there's not much protection. But, you know, over 6 days, we walked the length of this huge 90-mile beach, camping our tent every night, got the end, our hair thick with salt spray, sunburn, and we looked at each other and we said, wow, we've walked 90-mile beach. Oh, let's just keep going. And, so we did.
You're in Christchurch. And you fly up to Auckland, I guess, to start your journey?
Yeah, we flew and up to Wangarei.
Wangarei. And then what, you took a bus to the top?
We were very lucky. We had a lovely local person give us a lift all the way to the top. So, a customised delivery all the way up.
Because it's a long way from Wangarei to the top, right? People don't appreciate that. It's a long, long way. And yeah, then you hop out with your two little packs.
Mm-hmm.
And you spent 6 days, did you say, walking 90 Mile Beach.
Yeah.
How amazing.
Ah, it was. I mean, once the panic kind of subsided, the exhilarating and giddy sense of freedom just absolutely, you know, buoyed us down the entire length of the beach. Now, there's something really special, Rodney, about being self-contained with everything you need upon your back. You know, you have your tent, your shelter, so you can stay safely. You have your food, your clothing to keep warm. One of the things I really love about tramping in particular is that, you know, you really learn what is truly essential, you know, what you really need in life, which is very little, some warmth, some shelter, and, you know, some companionship can be really beautiful too. And for me, I was so fortunate to, you know, to spend the next 6 months in the company of just, you know, of course I'm biased being her mum, but just the most beautiful, special, bubbly, funny, good-natured little girl I've ever met. So I felt really, really blessed to have this time out with Emily.
Did you talk a lot?
Yeah, one of us talked a lot more than the other. We talked a lot. We told stories. I mean, basically, we just sort of chatted along in our own language, which we kind of still do to an extent, only she's 10 now, so it's a lot more sophisticated. We played in the sand dunes.
Did you yourself get lonely for adult company?
Yes, definitely at times. At times it wasn't so much adult company, but I wished that my therapist could come and hold my hand and walk a while with me because, you know, often when what I didn't expect on Te Araroa was memories that had so long been out of reach that were just kind of buried in this grey, kind of gently humming haze to become clear. I didn't expect this, and perhaps I wasn't very well prepared for this. And often, you know, these sort of sensations of would roll through me, and I would very much want to be able to turn and say, is this okay? Am I doing this right? Am I going to be okay? That would have been very nice, but that wasn't available. So I just kind of clung on and rode through it.
We're talking to Victoria Bruce about her amazing daughter, Emily, and her walk on the Te Araroa Trail over 138 days, 3,000 kilometres. And I feel very blessed to be on this journey with you, Victoria. And not just on this journey, but to have you sharing your life and a childhood that most of us just can't imagine what that would be like or what it would do to you. And I suppose you're on this journey with a lot of thinking time, not just flat stick busy getting through the day. So you're walking along the beach and you're thinking, and you get into your sleeping bag at night and Emily's fast asleep and you're thinking, and you get up in the morning and you're thinking. So things that would have been long pushed down come up. But on this journey, you dealt with them. And you dealt with them on your own with your daughter, which must have been wonderful. What happens after 90 Mile Beach? Where do you go then, walking-wise?
Actually, right after 90 Mile Beach, we had a bit of a hiccup. We got into the campground at Ahipara, you know, so swollen with joy and so proud of ourselves. And we got back to the real world for the first time in, you know, over a week, internet and news media, and learned that the next day Northland was going into a level 3 lockdown, which was just kind of having a bit of the rug ripped out from under your feet, I suppose, which meant, you know, no movement and no more walking and a lot of uncertainty for us and some of the other Te Araroa walkers around us who, you know, weren't really from Northland and didn't really necessarily have places to go or places to be there. So this meant, well, one of the really important lessons that this brought me very early was about how to deal with adversity, because things, even the best made plans, don't go as planned. And that is, I think, a big part of the journey of a long walk. You know, you can be planned as much as you can with your food and everything in your control, but there is so much outside of your control, such as weather, such as, you know, the political surrounds of the day. So it just teaches you to, how do you respond to adversity? Are you able to kind of flow through it? Is it something that, you know, you really struggle with and you create a lot of grief for yourself in fighting against it? It was a really good lesson for me, I think, very early on in the trail. And for us, what it meant was that we, you know, we took advice from the various government departments, and for us it meant that we had to leave Northland, and at that time Auckland and the Waikato were also under lockdown, and so for us we decided that we would rejoin the trail in the most northernmost part of the North Island that was not under lockdown, which was Tomaranui. So basically, fast forward 900 kilometres. which means a lot in terms of, you know, you have the mindset of wanting to, I guess, you know, to through hike, to walk from one place to another. And also in terms of the weather, I mean, this was very early October. You know, you start somewhere like Northland, which is, you know, obviously going to be warmer and, you know, early spring, and you kind of wind your way through to the higher plateau. For example, you know, Tongariro in early spring is not a very kind or easy place to be. And so we had to then, you know, deal with that and manage some adverse weather conditions, which meant that, you know, you just have to be flexible and change your plans.
It seems a little odd to me, mind you, the whole COVID thing was complete madness, but you could travel through and start walking again. But I would have thought you'd be as safe as a house and no threat to anyone up in the hills tramping.
Yeah, I think a lot of people who spend time in the hills, we share the same view, Rodney.
How crazy. So you started then at, what was it, Taumarunui, you said?
Yeah, Taumarunui.
How did
yeah.
you travel that distance?
From Taumarunui to in between distance? Or
yeah, how did you travel?
Just a plane and a bus.
Wow.
Mm.
Which is crazy.
Yeah, man. So it was quite a, you know, I really you'd loved
be really,
being in
you'd
Northland.
You'd be really upset. You'd be really upset at that. But you said this was one of the things that outside your control, I'll handle it. Because...
Yeah, and... There was something I also learned about myself too, and I think a lot of people who have experienced trauma is that you like to have your life very tightly under control. It helps you feel safe. And when things don't go as planned, you feel unsafe and you struggle to regain control. And it helped me, I guess, to, you know, to look back at myself and aspects of my life where, you know, perhaps my rigidity and inflexibility had prevented, you know, different experiences from coming through, or it had changed the way that I view different view experiences. So, yeah, it was a big lesson early on, just to, you know, take the trail. You're on the journey. You know, it's a bit like jumping into a river, isn't it? You know, you can't really control it. You can just, you're in your kayak, you're going down a river. You can't stop the flow. The best you can do is just paddle occasionally and try to steer.
And sometimes that's a very good journey. Sometimes that's a very good metaphor for life.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, and Taumarunui, where do you walk then?
So we sort of went from this beautiful wilderness of sand dunes and stunted coastal scenery and, just the beauty of Northland to suddenly walking some back roads through farmland with, you know, the rolling cultivated hills of kind of King Country, which for me was quite a downer. I really struggled with feeling quite bummed out by that. I didn't want to be walking the back roads. I wanted to be, you know, deep in the wilderness. But, these things pass, and after the kilometers pass underfoot, you know, eventually we did find ourselves back in the bush, walking in the Tongariro Forest Park up onto the central plateau of Tongariro, and the beautiful, you know, volcanic alpine scenery and big mountains and so on. And I guess also for us, because we were in the COVID time where, you know, our borders were closed to international visitors, this was actually a time when Te Araroa was very quiet. You know, a huge percentage of people who walk Te Araroa come from overseas, you know, countries where perhaps through hiking is more developed, you know, Europe and the States and so on. And at this particular time, it was a quiet time for us. So we didn't meet many people. We did spend long periods, you know, wandering through without seeing another soul, which for me at that time was wonderful. I think Emily would have loved a lot more socialization. She very much enjoyed meeting all the different people on the way. But I guess for me, I was, kind of busy processing some big stuff. and I really appreciated the peace and quiet.
Do you sort of on this trail pop out at a town every now and then to get supplies?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's it.
So what,
it.
Every
yeah.
few days you end up, the trail actually takes you there, or do you need to divert?
It depends. Sometimes you need to divert, and sometimes it does meander through little towns. So the way I kind of prepared for it logistically was sort of measuring it all up into sections. You know, for example, 90 Mile Beach, you start at, you know, the Cape, and you have to walk, 100 kilometres before you get to the next town, which was, in that case, Ahipara. So, you know, you need to budget your food and water, if necessary, to last that distance. And then the next section, you know, however many kilometres before you pop out and you can get some more food. So for in the North Island, it's, you know, a bit more populated, so the sections perhaps are not as long, although having said that, we did spend 10 days walking from Palmerston North through the Tararua Range until we came out, you know, the backskirts of sort of Wellington, which was a huge section for us. But the South Island is a lot more remote. So, you know, logistically you need to be much better prepared. You might pop out, say near Arthur's Pass, but there's still many kilometres of road walking before you can get yourself to a shop. So, yeah, being very well organised and self-sufficient, but also being able to deal with adversity and being flexible and trying your best to inject fun into what are sometimes, you know, quite challenging and dismal situations, such as, you know, day five in the rain, peeling your wet walking clothes back on and coaxing your little seven-year-old out of her warm sleeping bag and back into her muddy knee-length socks. With only a wet fruit purse as an incentive.
Did Emily ever sit down and say, that's it?
Oh, tell you what, Rodney, I really wish sometimes that she had. No, she was amazing. You know, often she didn't particularly want to leave the huts, especially if there was, less than ideal weather outside. But I recall, you know, sections, me carrying my big pack, you know, up into the foothills of the Alps, and her up the trail up the head of, ahead of me, chattering away, watching her little orange bottom and those little trail shorts. And I used to think to myself, my God, I wish she would just turn around, throw her pack in the ground and say, Mummy, I've had enough. And I would say, me too. Oh, let's put the tent up, shall we? But you know, bless her, she never did. She was a fabulous little tramping companion, and it was just wonderful to watch her develop and grow with her own, you know, brand of resilience and the pure joy, you know, of her exploring and discovering her natural world, and also me, you know, being able to kind of reconnect with the natural world through her eyes. It was really, really beautiful. She loved swimming. She would always, you know, every time there was a creek or a lake or, you know, a river, you know, you'd blink and there'd be this little bare bottom, you know, lying on the rock rocks or dabbling around in the stream. It was just lovely seeing how happy and comfortable she was, you know, in the outdoors. A gift that I really think is going to set her up really well in her adult life.
Did you keep a diary?
Yeah, she kept a diary. I kept notes, you know, written notes on my phone, and I also produced a blog for the Federated Mountain Clubs. But Emily had a diary that she kept every day. It has a section, you know, for writing about the day and the illustration, a whole page for illustrations, and she loves drawing. She's a beautiful little artist, and every day she would draw a picture from her mind of the day that we'd had. And I love looking back at them because sometimes I have memories of this hard, hot slog of a day, but in her memory, she's got these illustrations of her and I lying on rainbow-coloured beach towels by a beautiful stream with, you know, little blue ducks flowing past it, and we're having ice creams, and it's just so gorgeous to see, yeah, the joy and imagination coming through from her.
I am looking at the web page for the trail. And the enormity of it is daunting. Like,
yeah, absolutely.
This trail is 3,000 kilometers, and like the route burn, I think, is 32. And people feel pretty adventurous walking the route burn.
I need to get over to the West Coast, Rodney. That's where the real adventure is.
Yeah. And it looks like there's 160 maps that make up the trail. Like that'd be, I don't know what they are in metric terms, but the old one inch to, what is it, one inch to something or other maps, the old lands and survey maps. I'm just looking at it. I honestly can't believe that you did it. I can't believe that anyone does it. But I can imagine that once you start, it becomes the most beautiful thing. I'm looking at it like walking through the Marlborough Sounds. Just amazing. And then coming down through the Lewis Pass, through those hills, you'd be doing up and down, looks like Lake Sumner there, and then into Canterbury. Oh, my goodness me. What a trip that you've done. Oh, through Canterbury, you're going through, you come along through the hills, way up in the hills. In fact, you cross into the West Coast, I see.
Yeah, very briefly over the Harper Pass, which was, still one of my favourite memories, you know, coming through that kind of, the monoculture of the beech forest of Canterbury, and then popping up over this beautiful historic pass and descending into just this lush jungle of the West Coast.
And then part of the Mackenzie.
Very special place.
Mackenzie Country.
Yep, the drylands, yep.
And when you met other trampers, like, you'd be goddesses. Like, I'd be up there thinking, oh, I've been 2 days in the bush and I've climbed to this hut. It's amazing. And then a young mum and a daughter walks in and you say, oh, yeah, how you going? Oh, we're going good. How was your trip? Oh, not bad. We started in Northland, Cape Reinga.
Yeah.
And I'd say, what?
Emily very much enjoyed her her little bit of notoriety and fame in that, you know, sometimes she would walk into a hut and people be like, oh, are you Emily? It even still happens today in some places. So I'm Emily. So she really enjoys.
Because I'm the Federated Mountain Clubs, and that they were following the blog.
Yes.
How wonderful. I've got tears in my eyes.
Oh, thank you.
Just, honestly are so excited and amazed. And then you walk through Southland and you arrived in Bluff.
Yep, through the Longwood forests and then some beach walking through the metropolis of Invercargill and onto Bluff, which was really a mixed bag for me. I, by that stage, you know, very much didn't want it to end because, Rodney, it's really interesting, you know, us humans, how well we adapt, whether it's a good thing or not, how well we adapt to the situations that we're in. And, you know, after a good 6 months of life being reduced to the simplicity of, you know, waking up, making breakfast, packing up, going for a walk, finding a place to set up, you know, eat, sleep, repeat. There's a beautiful methodical simplicity to this way of life. And, you know, you notice so much of what's around you. You know, you notice the slower pace, obviously walking, but the slow pace of, you know, how the plants change and how the mountains change. You can wake up and see a mountain pass, you know, miles ahead of you. And, you know, as the days pass by, you get closer and closer until you're up over it and through it and on the other side. It's a really beautiful and simple and special existence. And I was very, I guess, worried about what life would look like after Te Araroa. And, you know, as we were going into Bluff, I think I was tugging Emily's hand and saying, oh, come on, let's just turn around and walk the other way. We can be Nobo walkers. So there's some acronyms. Sobo means a southbound walker, the ones that walk from the top to the bottom. And Nobos are the ones that that walk the other way. And she said, no, Mummy, come on. You know, we can have more adventures afterwards. I want to get an ice cream. Come on, Mummy.
6 months.
Yeah.
And, of course,
we wandered out into Bluff.
The peculiar thing is, this is how people used to live.
Yes.
You know, like I look at Mace down here in Otago and the families would walk over this incredible walk just to get home. The miners. And then I've read accounts of the wonderful early missionaries to New Zealand and they'd literally walk the length of the North Island, spreading the good word to tribes, no tracks, and danger from humans. And that's how we used to live, and you recreated that. How did it change you?
I would say that it really helped me to have a much deeper relationship with myself and to really grow my confidence in myself and in my abilities, and also to, I guess, really come to a place of forgiveness and acceptance of myself, because, you know, in this busy, messed up, crazy world, it's really important to have your own back. And I think that's where it really helped me. Also, you know, I feel having that time with Emily, of course, as being a single mother, we've always been really close, but, you know, it helped us really forge this very deep, loving bond with one another, you know, very supportive of one another, very caring, able to weather anything together. And I think, you know, once you feel more comfortable and accepting with yourself of yourself, then I guess this sort of extends outwards. You know, your view of yourself is positive, therefore, you know, you have more tolerance and compassion and hopefully acceptance of people around you. So I feel, you know, that my ability to kind of connect more deeply with people around me has definitely improved, which is really, really important to me.
And how did it change Emily?
Emily. Emily is just such a warm-hearted little soul. You know, she's incredibly generous in her spirits. You know, she really loves people and cares about people. And she is fabulous at talking to adults. You know, she has a lot of friends and connections who are, you know, older people. And I think also, you know, for her self-confidence, you know, that deep-seated knowledge, you know, that within yourself that you are okay and, you know, you can do hard things. I really see that in her, in the way that she, you know, her attitude towards life and towards herself and other people.
Because when you're seven, 6 months is a lifetime.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Do you have a relationship with anyone in your immediate family?
I don't. Oh, at the moment, no, I don't. I have a half-sister from my father's first marriage who I didn't grow up with, who lives in France and who I feel close to. We have very separate lives, but we do manage to, you know, to stay in touch. But no, I don't have a relationship with anyone in my immediate family, and that is, I guess, an ongoing source of angst and distress to me at times, Rodney. It's definitely something. I think what something that my therapist said to me was that, you know, what really helps is to be able to identify our wounds. Like, we might know that we hurt, but we don't understand why. And when your wounds are complex, as in it wasn't just an event, you know, there's a multitude of things that happened. It really helps to be able to take the time. And Te Araroa was just, I guess, the tip of the iceberg for me on this journey. You know, it gave me time. I had lots of time to think, to feel, to remember little snippets of things all flashing around, to be able to kind of put together sort of that humming gray, you know, this gray absence of memory. I'm now able to kind of piece together a picture. And not just a picture from a little child's mind, but, you know, a picture from my adult mind of what my early life looked like and who are these people. And often I do get these deep pangs of grief because, you know, for the first 9 years of my life, my mother and father and my big brother, they were the only people I knew. You know, we lived a very insular life together, and my relationship with my brother was incredibly deep. You know, I maybe didn't really notice my parents that much. I didn't particularly really need anything from them because my brother was my whole world. And as I, you know, get older, I'm 39 now, my thoughts often go to him because he was such a special person to me. And I would love to reconnect with him and, you know, share this sentiment with him one day. And also to get his views on, you know, our childhood, how it affected him and how he felt.
Do you think he'd read your book?
He might too. Yeah, I'm not sure.
Are your mum and dad still alive?
They are, to the best of my knowledge, yes. Yeah.
Are you going to Emily and you walk from the end of 90 Mile Beach to Taumanui?
Yeah, maybe one day. We have talked about it. I guess that for me, you know, we kind of lived in Taupō when Emily was little. We lived in South Auckland. And to me, for a kind of ecological and nature-based sense, these parts of the trail, kind of very urban, the landscape is not natural. It's very farmland and altered. And so, you know, the physical endurance part of, you know, just walking that length would be one thing. But in terms of really enjoying being deep in the New Zealand bush, which is what I love doing, it probably wouldn't do very much for me. Mm. But after Te Araroa until today, we have kept up our tramping adventures.
I was going to ask that because I wondered, how long was it before you went tramping after that trip?
Oh, you know, probably like the next weekend. I think, I celebrated.
That's so great.
Couldn't wait to get back in there. Yeah, and what we do now is that we do a lot more off track, so navigating off track and, using kind of, you know, backcountry bushcraft skills and climbing higher. I would say, you know, if we wanted to count the days that Emily and I have spent in the bush after Te Araroa and the kilometres that we've walked, well, I really should do the maths on it sometime because Emily recently celebrated visiting over 300 huts in the Department of Conservation Hut Network. And I think she'd been to 100, 120 maybe after Te Araroa. So, you know, that's quite an achievement for a 10-year-old girl. But also we spend, you know, numerous nights tenting, camping out. I'm a little bit hooked, Rodney. It's kind of like, you know, my fix now is to
and put do you regard it as your therapy now?
Absolutely. Yeah. For me, it really has become a way for me to take charge, I suppose, of my therapeutic journey because, you know, there's another side which I haven't really put in the book, but you know, the frustration and distress and of trying to get help in New Zealand for complex trauma has been, it's really hard, you know, and it's almost hopeless. You know, I like to consider myself an educated person who knows how to advocate for myself, but I've just come up against barriers at every turn when I try to seek help through the public system for, you know, the symptoms of PTSD. It's been really, really hard. And however, you know, for me, going tramping regularly is just a form of therapy, a form of helping myself, giving myself time out to process, you know, the emotion and being able to transform it into something productive, think and reflect.
And you've got Emily to live for.
Yeah, absolutely.
And to give her the wonderful, not just a wonderful childhood, but an amazing childhood because she walked Te Araha with her mum.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, look, you know, as a single mother without, you know, extensive resources, I guess guilt is something that, you know, I do struggle with, not being able to afford certain experiences or after school activities or whatever for Emily, but you know, being able to take her out in the mountains to, you know, we'll climb up here, we'll spend the night at the Biv, or we'll camp by the tarn, you know, we'll build a snowman, we'll eat some chocolate biscuits, we'll read your favorite book, and you know, laugh and have fun and use our big, strong bodies to get up there and have an experience together. Hopefully that's, you know, just as good or even better than being able to afford the latest gadget or pay for expensive after-school activities.
Oh, the book that we've been discussing is by our guest, Victoria Bruce. I am so getting this book. It's called Adventures with Emily, Walking the Tiaraha Trail, 138 Days with Your 7-Year-Old Daughter. I just see that you can get it as an electronic book as well. And prologue, day 106, the wind is silent until it counters objects, and then it can command an orchestra of sound that drowns out all other noise, plucking the harp strings of the branches and banging the drums of rocks, building up intensity until it transforms peaceful landscapes into terrifying infernos of energy and motion. Wind over land flows like water over rocks, picking up speed, increasing in energy with everything it touches, unchecked and insatiable. It runs around corners, gallops through gaps, contorts across cliff faces, rolls around bluffs and tears through tussock, pummeling everything in its path in a deafening, all-consuming roar. I'm lying in my sleeping bag, holding my 7-year-old daughter tight in my arms, the thin fabric of our ultralight tent pressed against my face, waiting for the next gust to rip the roof off our flimsy shelter and suck us into the night sky. We're camping at 950 metres elevation in a valley encircled by dark, craggy peaks. A high mountain pass is behind us and ahead a narrow funnel of a creek that eventually opens into the icy blue expanse of Lake Hawea. Our front is moving swiftly across the Southern Alps and we're in the middle of it. The previously rain-swollen clouds have run up against the rock wall of the mountains and dumped their load into the jungles of the west coast. Now, jubilantly free of burden, they've risen over the mountains and are descending upon us. That's beautiful, Victoria.
Thank you.
That was Victoria Bruce, an amazing journey in every sense of the word. I haven't read the book, I'm about to. I'm going to go and get it. Beautiful book. And Victoria, you are truly a wonderful, wonderful woman and a wonderful, wonderful mum.
Thank you so much, Rodney. Thank you so much for having me on today.
Well, thank you for sharing all your life with us. It's been wonderful. We're on Rally Check Radio. It's been Real Talk with Rodney Height. You can send us a text on 2057, email us at inbox@rallycheck. And the book, Adventures with Emily, by Victoria Bruce. Man, I can't wait to read that book.
Are you loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it, and right now they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.